Good morning. How are we doing this morning? Everybody enjoy the trek up here to the end of the earth to get to the room? Yeah. I was looking for like one of those Segway transporters that would kind of help me get here, but it didn't work. So I left last night, and I got here in time for today. So. My name is Brian Nice. I'm going to be presenting a session this morning for you guys on enterprise network requirements for Link Server 2013. Now, there's a lot of things that we can talk about from a networking standpoint, and having about an hour, a little over an hour to fill, we kind of had to pick and choose what are some of the more common things that we talk about when it comes to network requirements with regards to Link. So what I wanted to really achieve out of this session was to talk through, first off, let's get a good grasp and understanding on some common ground terminology for networking. Concepts like quality of service, or what we call quality of experience in the Link world. Not just how Link itself does it, but you know, in networking as a whole. And then look at how Link consumes that, understand how Link can work with those particular elements, and then understand how we can help from a planning stage to model the aspects that we need to be concerned about when it comes to networking. So a key takeaway for you here is to really be able to have a good discussion with, and we use quotes here, the networking people, right? And I say networking people kind of tongue-in-cheek because my background also includes being a Cisco network engineer for a number of years. So I am one of those networking people. But you know, being able, they speak their own language, right? So being able to have a conversation, a dialogue with that particular group because, let's face it, right? Link as an application rides on top of the network. Right? If the network is not configured properly, is not architected properly, and so forth, Link will suffer. And as an end result, the end user's experience will suffer. And who's going to get the blame at that point? Right? Whatever's facing the end user, which tends to be the Link client, hey, this client doesn't work right. Well, it could be something that we could plan a little bit better for, something we can architect a little bit better for. So that's what we want to try to talk through in this session. So I'm going to start off with a real quick networking review. Okay, this I'm not intending to spend, you know, like half of the session talking about the basics of networking, right? I just want to make sure that we all get on the same page with the terminology that I'm going to be using. So I would expect most of you, if you're here for this session, that you would probably have a good grasp on these. So bear with me for the first, you know, quick 5-10 minutes here while we just get everybody on a level playing field as far as terminology goes. Then we'll dig into really the two core aspects that I want to talk about today. One of which is quality of service, which is a very important component for us in the Link world. So understanding, again, terminology around QoS and how Link is going to consume quality of service. And then focus our attention on the network bandwidth for Link and understand how some of the new modalities in Link are going to affect our network planning, specifically things like video. Right? We have this multi-gallery view now in our video conferences, for example. What does that mean when it comes to planning for networks? Right, so let's try to get a good understanding, good handle on how Link consumes that bandwidth and then how we can plan for that bandwidth. So a little slide about me. I live in Mission Viejo, California. It's in Southern California. My SIP address is also my email address that you see there. I've been with Microsoft since about 2011. I've been doing architect and consulting work for over 15 years. I'm a certified master in Link 2010 and an MCSM in 2013 communications. I also helped to deliver and write the curriculum for the master's program. And in the top right corner, that's my drum set at my house. I like to play drums. So, quick review of networking, real fast stuff. Right, when we look at vocabulary for networking, typically we look at the basics, right? The ANs, the wide area networks, the local area networks, and so forth. From Link's perspective, obviously, we are very, very concerned about wide area networks, right? Because as we're going to be pushing traffic across the WAN, we need to know we have a finite amount of bandwidth, we have a finite amount of classified traffic, so how are we going to get the best performance from that perspective? Local area networks, still important, but you know, local area networks are a little bit more forgiving in the sense that some organizations can have 100 meg, even gig, down to the desktop. So making sure that we account for both of those. We're going to be spending a lot of time talking about the wide area network, but we'll talk about the LAN side of the house too. Right, we have our layer 2, layer 3. I won't bring up the OSI stack. Okay, not going to put you through that pain this morning. But we do care about a couple of layers of the OSI stack, specifically layers 2 and 3, right? Because layer 2 Nowadays, typically we're seeing that at the LAN layer from an Ethernet perspective. You can, in some cases, even see it on WAN networks. Layer 3, of course, we're all familiar with the IP layer. We're going to be doing a lot of digging around in these layers when we start talking about how we're dealing with quality of service. The OSes, as we call them, right? The class of service, type of service, you'll hear these referred to a lot. Class of service typically is used at layer 2, whereas a TOS marking or a type of service would be at layer 3. Oftentimes, networking folks will use that word cost just kind of as a generic term. And that may make sense to them from a networking perspective, right? But if you're coming into it from the link side of the house, your definition of costs may not be the same as theirs, and then we throw things like quality of experience in there at you, and you're like, what is this thing? I'm trying to make sure that I have this common ground to discuss. So we're really going to be focusing on that third option that's there, which is DSCP, which is Differentiated Services Code Point. This is a way that we'll see in a little bit that we can use to mark the packets for proper classification so that we can identify the difference between my important traffic that's on the network and my not-so-important traffic that's on the network. Real basic stuff, hopefully you all know these. You know, VPNs, QoS, MPLS. VPNs, not really happy in the VPN world when it comes to link, right? And that's really because VPNs don't really care about traffic, right? VPNs are all about creating an encrypted tunnel, right? So when I'm starting to send real-time traffic through a VPN, it doesn't care that it's real-time traffic. It cares that it's traffic that needs to be encrypted, so it's going to chunk it up and encrypt it and send it on its merry way. Well, real-time traffic doesn't do really well when you start adding these extra layers to it, things like encryption and so forth. We will spend a good chunk of time on quality of service and bandwidth analysis, and that's where the MPLS side of the house will come into play. Speaking of which, this is a nice breakdown of what MPLS networks are. In case you haven't ever worked in the networking space before, an MPLS network, like we say, it's a layer 3 WAN. It's built by a service provider to sell bandwidth to many customers and possibly allow quality of service, assuming that you actually pay for quality of service. And you'll hear terms that we'll throw around a lot in this session, and you may even hear them talking from the networking team where they say, oh, that's in our gold car. What the heck? What is the gold car, right? So being able to understand that kind of terminology and how that quality of service term applies in the link environment. Again, you'll sometimes hear them refer to, networking engineers refer to MPLS as the cloud, which is a bit disconcerting because pretty much everything now is called the cloud. Right, so we're going to the cloud. Oh, we're going to MPLS? No, we're going to the cloud. Not the cloud, the cloud. And just, yeah, so, and you, it's true, you will see it depicted in networking diagrams as well as a nice big cloud. So you kind of look at it and go, oh, that must be the cloud. Well, not really. MPLS is the most common environment that we're going to see, and this will become very relevant later in the presentation when we start looking at bandwidth modeling, and we look at our bandwidth calculator tool, which is really built around this MPLS network architecture. We can't forget about, yes, we have WANs, but we can't forget about the internet, right? The internet is technically a WAN network too, right? It's a publicly accessible WAN network that has no guarantee of anything. Right? That's pretty much what the internet is, right? It is not a series of tubes filled with cats. Okay, it's actually a one-of-a-kind public network, but the important thing to realize is Link will use this network. So we have to understand that from a networking provisioning perspective. We also have to understand it from a quality perspective, right? Because doing all these things around quality of service works extremely well when the network is intelligent enough to respect the quality of service things that we're doing. Get yourself out on the internet. Sorry, you know, all bets are off, because it's an unmanaged network, so there's not a lot of guarantee that we can have in that world. You may also hear terms like IP VPN versus Internet VPNs, right? A lot of times IP VPN is more synonymous with MPLS, whereas Internet VPN is a technology that providers will actually use to overlay a VPN topology across the internet to give you those private connections, maybe a site-to-site style VPN, but backboned over the internet. All of these network types are important to understand because when you go to have discussions with the networking teams and you want to start doing the planning for Link, you have to be able to understand the current architecture that's in place so that you can better understand how Link is going to take advantage of it. Good old-fashioned Wi-Fi, this always comes up as well. Link 2013 now does support Wi-Fi networks, right? In 2010, it was not officially supported to run Link on Wi-Fi. You could do it, have fun, but there really wasn't anything that made it a, quote, supported scenario. 2013 has been engineered, the media stack has been engineered to work on Wi-Fi networks as well. And we've got a link here to a cool white paper that you can go and check out for deploying and delivering Link 2013 over Wi-Fi. We're not going to talk a lot about Wi-Fi in this session, although a lot of the concepts that we're going to talk about would be applicable to the Wi-Fi network, especially when we talk about things like QoS. Ah, the fun ones. Latency, jitter, and packet loss, right? Latency, jitter, packet loss. What are these things? Why do we care about them? Does it affect voice? Does it affect video? Does it affect anything else? And why do we care? Right. Well, we care because Link is going to be affected by any or all of these. Some of these we actually have the capability of controlling. Some of these we can't. So when we look at latency, for example, you know, we start trying to deal with what can Link survive with regards to these values. Now, I have a small pet peeve about looking at values for delay, jitter loss, and so forth. And that's that at any given time, you could probably go to four or five different TechNet links and get four or five different numbers. The first thing that you have to look for is making sure that you are looking at common values, in the sense that when you look at measuring delay and jitter and loss, it could either be measured in one way, right, which is what we would call latency, right? So source to destination, and I want to measure what's the latency involved in that in one direction. So as you say here, it could be, say, 150 milliseconds. But in the Link world, from the Link monitoring server, we like to report on round trip time, right? Round trip time is not latency, right? Because latency is one direction, right? Going in both directions, that's a round trip timer, right? That's not exactly the same as latency. When we look at these values in the monitoring server, though, you have to realize that the values that we're looking at are round-trip timer monitors. You know, so we have to make sure that when we look at this, if I see 150 milliseconds, that's a round-trip time, right? As opposed to maybe if I saw 300 milliseconds, that's a round-trip time. Don't think of that as, ooh, that he said 150 for latency. No, that's not a latency number. That's a round-trip timer number. So what I've done in this chart is I've color-coded a few things for you based on how we would do in the monitoring server. Right, if you were to look in the monitoring reports, we actually will color code some of these things for you. When we start seeing warnings or errors or something of that nature, we'll typically color them yellow, we'll color them red. Right? These are the thresholds that we're going to see. Right? So on average, less than 200 milliseconds tends to be considered good. Right? Over 200 milliseconds, not so good. Over 500 milliseconds, you got a problem. Now, these numbers are great when you look at a chart. These numbers are not so great when you put them into practice and realize that, from my perspective, the numbers are useless without context. Right? If you don't put some context around these numbers, they really don't mean a whole lot. For example, if I am looking at measuring round-trip time between the Seattle office and the Los Angeles office, right, and I see 250 milliseconds round-trip time, that's not so good to me, because I know the distance that's involved. I know what that engineered link should be. But if I'm talking about, say, from San Francisco to Australia, right, if I see 100 milliseconds round trip time, I know you're lying, because we have this little thing called physics, right? It only goes so far, so fast. So context becomes key. These are good average numbers to look at, but you must always put context around these to get the full understanding of what is it that we're interested in and what can we really survive. Right? So these are the base numbers that we work through that you would see inside of the monitoring server. Right? For more details, there was a session yesterday that my friends Nick and Scott did on monitoring. There's lots of good data that you can get in there related to this. So I won't spend too much time digging in for delay, jitter, loss. The jitter value. Jitter is a fun one, right? Because jitter is really all about trying to compensate for packet delay, right? And we compensate by using what's called a jitter buffer, right? So as I'm sending data across the wire, I'm sending this real-time data across the wire, I can collect that into a jitter buffer, and I can start playing that audio back to you so that you can hear it, right? And I'm basically compensating for the fact that some packets may arrive a little bit later, but that's okay because I've got this thing buffered up. So I'm kind of hedging my bet that the packets are going to get here before that jitter buffer gets empty, and you as an end user are not really going to notice the difference. Now, jitter, of course, can increase the latency, right? Because think about it. We're sending the data across the wire, and we're queuing it up, right? So that's taking longer for you to actually hear what that person said. If this gets too far out of whack, you end up with the walkie-talkie scenario, right? Where somebody starts talking, and you're like, did he say anything? And then you go to start talking, and you end up talking over them. Wait, what'd you say? Who? And you end up doing that back and forth because it's taking too long for that data to get there, right? So you might think, oh, well, jitter buffer, that's cool. Let's just make it a really big jitter buffer. Well, no, because that would make it even worse, right? We have to have that timed out appropriately so that the packets are coming in and can be streamed out to the user so they can hear them in an intelligible fashion, right? If we end up getting these packets too late, right, they may arrive, but too late for us to play them because we've already played that part of the conversation through the jitter buffer, we're just going to drop them. And that's when you start hearing popping sounds, or you start hearing misses in the audio conversation, right? Because we're now starting to empty out the jitter buffer faster than the data can come in. So some numbers here, again, less than 20 milliseconds is technically quote-unquote good. 30 milliseconds over, not so good. Over 45, pretty bad, right? Again, same thing. This is really trying to be wrapped around context, right, and understanding these values that we're looking at. We also need to better understand how we can survive and solve some of these things, right? Now, as we'll talk about in a little bit, the media stack can solve some of these things, like we said with jitter buffers and so forth. Some of them we just simply can't overcome, right? One-way latency, you just can't overcome that unless you re-engineer the link, and even then, you're going to get to a point where the laws of physics are going to kick in, and that's just the best that you're going to get. This one's a killer, right? Packet loss. We don't like it when packets are lost. Right, because packet loss basically means we don't hear anything, we don't see anything, right? In the world of video, this could mean that your video freezes, right? So, and that usually for me happens at a most inopportune time, right? When I have that really funky look on my face, that's when my video tends to freeze. And that could be because we've lost packets, right? Now, the interesting thing when you start talking about packet loss, and we'll get into this in a little bit when we look at codecs, right? The purpose of the codecs themselves is compression decompression, right? So take that data, compress it down, send it across the wire. When we look at audio codecs, we typically get compression ratios anywhere from 1 to 2 to 1 to 8, right? Depending on the audio codec that we're using. So when we start looking at packet loss in the voice world, we lose some packets. Yeah, it's sort of kind of noticeable, right? And then if we lose enough packets, of course, you get to hear dead air or hear nothing. But in the video world, the codecs can go all the way up to like 1 to 1,000 for compression, right? So now you start dropping video packets, you're losing a lot more data compared to, say, losing audio packets. That's why when all of a sudden we get into these lossy networks, video is the first thing to go, right? Starts freezing, we try to make some adaptations to the network, and at some point we're going to cut our losses and go, yep, psh, video's done, right? We've got to cut video out of the mix because we're just losing too much data. Right, so losing the same number of voice packets versus video packets, it's much more detrimental to lose the video packets because of the compression ratio being so high. There are, of course, certain things that we can do to alleviate packet loss, certain things we can do to alleviate jitter. That's going to be our quality of service discussion coming up. Of course, here we look at our thresholds. Under 3% is pretty good. Over 5, sometimes over 7. Could be considered not good. And again, this is wrapped around context too. We say here some consider over 7% a huge amount of packet loss. It just depends on the type of data that we're sending across. I mean, obviously in the video world, over 7%, yeah, that's extremely huge for us. Over 10%, really not good. Right? So we throw these numbers in here just to give you awareness when you start looking in the monitoring reports, hey, my user had a poor experience on this call, and we start looking, oh yeah, well, their packet loss rate was blah, or their jitter was X, or what have you. And now we can start wrapping some context around these numbers. The cool thing is, that's kind of reactive, right? What I want to take you through in the rest of this session is how do we become more proactive so that we don't get ourselves into this mess, right? Because we really don't want to find out by looking in monitoring reports that, oh, wow, we've got that particular problem, whether it's jitter, whether it's packet loss, or so forth. All right, the QoS stuff. Why do we talk about QoS? Because QoS can help solve some of those problems that we were talking about, right? Not latency. We're not going to fix, you know, latency with quality of service, right? We can help jitter. We can help packet loss, right? Quality of service is really about a number of technologies that have to work together to enable organizations to optimize the end user's experience for data, in this case, for real-time audio, real-time video. Right? Now, quality of service is not a silver bullet that, hey, if I just turn on quality of service and tick the little checkbox and, hey, life is good, everything's going to magically work. There's some engineering that's involved, right, to get quality of service configured. Oftentimes, customers will go, yeah, you know what? I don't really need to use quality of service because I have plenty of bandwidth, right? I've got, you know, 20 meg links into the MPLS cloud. Yes, I said it. Into the MPLS cloud. So I don't need to, 20 meg, we're fine with that site that's only got 50 users. Yeah, it's not just about the amount of bandwidth that you have. Quality of service is about containing and controlling congestion on your network. Right? Yeah, it's great that you've got a 20 meg pipe, but what are you pushing through it at any given time? Right? Maybe it sort of averages out great, but you have bursts where you're kicking up against that 20 meg limit. What are we doing? How do we know which traffic is prioritized over the other traffic? That's what quality of service is all about, right? It's not just to say, well, I want to make sure that we have enough bandwidth. It's I want to make sure that we're using that bandwidth wisely, right? That's the point of quality of service for us. I find this slide entertaining because I've worked on Microsoft technologies for many, many years, and I remember way back in the day, it was like in the OCS days and even the Link 2010 days, where the original thought was, you don't need quality of service, right? Link is magical. It has these adaptive codecs, right? So go ahead and deploy it on your network that has, you know, 20% packet loss. We'll adapt. No, we won't. We can only adapt so far. That's the problem, right? So I don't want to take away from the value of the media stack that we have. It is extremely valuable, and I'll show you in a little bit what I mean by extremely valuable. But it's not the only tool in your arsenal, right, to be able to provide quality experiences to the end users. You can't just simply rely on the magic of the codec to get you where you need to be. Nope. You need to rely on quality of service as well. MSIT released a white paper that you see here. The importance of QoS cannot be overstated in our 100,000 user plus EV production deployment. Right, we have enterprise voice running for over 100,000 endpoints at MSIT. It was not a pretty sight when we didn't have quality of service configured properly. Right, and we saw it in the monitoring reports. You could see it plain as day, man, when these people were on this wired connection and we were using proper QoS and we were inside the network, we had like less than 2% poor call quality. It was awesome, right? We had people that were on wireless inside the environment with no QoS, we had like 15% of our calls were poor audio quality, right? It was just laughable when you started to look at these things. When we really need to dig into this and uniformly enforce and audit our QoS settings. That key point that I have underlined there is the biggest challenge that you will run into with customers and with network engineering teams is they will say, oh yeah, we got QoS deployed. Sure they do. Not right, but it's deployed, right? Or maybe they think it's deployed right, and they've got one router over here that a junior administrator went in and said, oh, let me try this command. I saw it on Bing. What does that do? Oh, it didn't do anything. And they blew up their QoS policies, right? So making sure that they're uniformly enforced and auditing those QoS settings is critical, right? Because Link can only do so much. If the network is going to undo what we tell it to do, we're not going to have a good day, right? It's going to be a bad day for us. People tend to think that network congestion is a thing of the past because we have so much available bandwidth. Yeah. Not necessarily outside the US, right? It's not really about having that 64K WAN link anymore, right? It's really about thinking here, I've got a 64K, you know, I may have a 64K link, I may have a 64K WAN connection, But if I want to download this 15 meg antivirus update, which gets out of a server in the data center with a gig-E connection to 500 users across this 100 meg link, I mean, look at the real basic simple math. We're going to congest that link for up to 10 minutes, just if everybody downloads that. Now, again, this is a real high level, you know, just showing you raw numbers. But think about this happening on your network. And now imagine that the same time this is going on, you're trying to do a voice call or a video call, right? Well, if the network is that congested, who wins? Right? Who gets priority over the other? Does anybody get priority over the other? Right? We all know, hey, my video call should take priority over that antivirus update. You know, I'll get the antivirus update, but I don't really need that like right now. When I'm doing a video call, I need to see you right now. The network doesn't know that unless you tell it, hey, this traffic is more important than that traffic. That's what quality of service is about for us. So the bottom line for us for QoS, we want to be able to treat different types of traffic differently, right? So I want to be able to say, my audio call should be treated this way. My video call should be treated that way. My application sharing, whatever, should be treated in this fashion, right? My internet surfing traffic should be treated in this fashion. That's the point of quality of service. Now, to be able to do that, we have to do two things, right? We have to be able to identify the traffic, and then we have to be able to classify it, right? So what is it, and what are you classified as? Are you high priority, or are you not? Are you scavenger, right? The different treatment mechanisms become the different QoS mechanisms, and often the term that we use for that is what we call queuing, right? Queuing is the most common mechanism that we're going to use when we deploy QoS from a networking standpoint, which is basically saying when that traffic comes in, I'm going to have these markings that tell me what this traffic is versus that traffic. You go in this bucket, you go in that bucket, and that's the sorting process that needs to happen so that the queuing mechanism can then say, oh, you're in the priority queue. Ooh, you go first, please, after you, right? Oh, you're in the scavenger queue, you know, you wait. Yeah, we'll give you bandwidth when it's available, and if there isn't any, tough luck, right? How do the devices distinguish it? There's lots of different ways that we can distinguish it by port range, which we'll talk about, by VLAN, by 802.1p, DiffServ, MPLS tags, right? The most common ways that we're going to talk about here today are ports and DSCP markings. These are the most common ways that we would approach quality of service. This is a key component because when we look at quality of service, you have to think of it as two different buckets, right? Two different components, if you will, for quality of service. There is a classification scheme and there's a marking scheme, and they are independent processes, right? The marking scheme is all about finding some way to identify and differentiate this traffic from this traffic, right? So, hey, here comes a packet. Is that an audio conversation? Is that a video conversation? Is that a desktop share? Is it web browser traffic? What is it? That's the idea of marking, right? Having the packets be marked so that when they reach a particular switch, router, ingress, egress point, what have you, we can look at that and go, oh yeah, I see that's an audio packet, and I know what to do with that. All right? We'll talk about ways to get around that and do some marking in a little bit. Once we have them marked, the devices now have the capability of classifying. Hey, I can now distinguish an audio packet from a video packet. So now I can properly classify them. Oh, the audio traffic, that's a real-time piece of traffic that needs to go into the real-time queue. Oh, video. It's not so much real-time as audio, but it's way more important than web browser traffic. Maybe that needs to go into this media streaming queue, and so on and so forth, right? So we can start to build out. And again, this doesn't just go for link. This is any traffic that's in your network environment, right? So if you have enterprise QoS deployed, your line of business apps could be in here. Like you see in the middle, we've got that AF3 national applications, right? Maybe my business critical apps are in there because I want to make sure that they get priority. But we're classifying these things in a rank order to be able to say, yeah, you know, national applications are important, but they're not as important as voice, right? Voice is more important than that, and we have to educate the networking environment about that. That's what traffic classification is all about. So how do we do it? At the layer two level, right, we can classify the traffic using priorities at the VLAN level using 802.1p markings. Now, VLAN priority level, If you're familiar with deploying legacy VoIP environments, you know, like Cisco, you could deploy. I'm kidding. I worked for. I did work with them. I'm allowed to say that. So they're a great sponsor. We love them. You'll come upon situations where you'll deploy voice over IP, and you'll have multiple VLANs. You'll have a data VLAN, and you'll have a voice VLAN, right? Why do they do that? Well, because they can tag at the VLAN priority level on the voice VLAN and say, hey, any traffic that's coming in on the voice VLAN, expedited forwarding, that's voice traffic, right? Because obviously, if you're a user, your PC is not going to be on the voice VLAN, right? You're going to be on the data VLAN. So we know your phone is plugged in, you've got a voice VLAN, and life is good. We can tag it that way. And that works extremely well in that style environment, right? That doesn't work out so well for us in the Link environment, because I don't have separate voice and data VLANs for Link. Could I? Yeah. Would I? No. Because think about what the main endpoint is that we use for Link. It's a soft phone. Well, that soft phone is on your laptop. You're going to be on the data VLAN. How do you tell your laptop, oh, I want the Link client traffic to go on the voice VLAN? Yeah, you can't. I don't think we're going to be putting, you know, H.L1P network adapters in everybody's machine so they can trunk. I don't think that's going to work out so well. So VLAN priority doesn't work out so well for us. 802.1p marking, yeah, only works when you have an 802.1q tagged VLAN, which means you need a network adapter that's capable of doing that. You're not going to get that on end user machines. Servers, maybe. Workstations, nah, not happening. So these traffic classification methods, not a great idea for us, for Link. That's okay, never fear. This is where we sit from a traffic classification mechanism. We sit here at layer 3, and we do it either port-based. Port-based basically means we have a range of ports, and we say, hey, if you see traffic, you see UDP traffic coming on this port range, you know, 50,000 to 50,028. You know, if you see anything in that port range on UDP, that's audio. Right? That's one way that you can do it. And the networking teams can do that and see, oh, I've got that traffic and I recognize that as audio, and that's great. Networking people really don't like to go that route because it's a lot of work, right? And invariably, fat finger syndrome is going to come into play, right? And you're going to mistype something, or the port range is going to be off, or somebody's going to change the port range and not tell you. And it's subject to a lot of challenges. So although that's an option, the networking team tends to not really like that particular option. There's also DSCP marking. This is the most common, most ubiquitous, and most highly recommended option that we have for being able to identify the traffic. And that is by basically tagging the traffic as it leaves your computer and saying, hey, that traffic that just went out, that's audio traffic. I'm going to tag that EF or 46 with a DSCP code. And the routers can look at that DSCP field and go, oh yeah, DSCP 46, expedited forwarding, that's voice, and they know exactly what to do with it. That's the most common way that we do it, right? It builds on the earlier TOS approach that we had mentioned earlier in the slides on IP precedence. Typically, we will assign these, and we'll see as we get into the Link section how we do it. We'll typically assign these through group policy, QoS policies inside of Active Directory. The phone devices, we have the capability of controlling those as well. PCs, this one's a little bit tricky, right? Because it is possible for you to tag at your PC level, but the networking team has to trust your endpoint. Right? So if you talk to networking folks and you say, hey, just blanket statement, I need you to just wholeheartedly trust that that endpoint is going to properly mark traffic, they're going to go, that's no. And they're just not going to do it. Because it doesn't take long for someone to go out on the web and find a utility that allows them to run on their laptop and tag their browsing traffic as 46. And now they're clogging up your priority queue with web browsing traffic. A lot of times network folks will say, no, we're not going to extend the trust to that port so that the workstation can tag it. We've solved that with Windows 7, Windows 8, by being able to do policy-based QoS. Right? So that basically means whatever we've told it to tag inside of group policy, we'll tag. And anything else that goes through the policy scheduler inside of the Windows operating system, if it's tagged by some other means, we just overwrite it back to zero. So now we thwart that person from going out and getting their little tool send their browsing traffic up to 46, when it comes through our scheduler, we go, yeah, no, that's not defined in our policy. Zero, and out it goes, right? That gives the network engineers a little bit more comfort to be able to deal with this. One that I didn't put up here, just for the hardcore networking folks in the room, there are technologies that Cisco has, for example, called NBAR, which is network-based application recognition, where the system can actually identify the traffic dynamically. Link traffic is now supported in their latest NBAR code that they have in their iOS, so that's another option for you, is you can configure NBAR to have it dynamically detect the RTP traffic that we have. Oh yeah, that's audio, and classify it accordingly. Queuing is fun, right? Queuing is really all about getting the data into the queues and shuffling them out. I don't want to spend a ton of time on this one, but really the point of the matter is here, is once we've identified it, I see that that's voice, now I've got to put it into a queue. Well, when that goes into the queue, right, there's a scheduler component that you see with the little kind of whirly thing there in the middle that's responsible for getting the data out of the queues, and it does it in a fair manner, but typically it does it in a weighted fair manner, right? So I've got 10% in this queue, I've got 30% in that queue, so that queue is weighted, so I'm going to give more precedence to that than the other one, right? So, and it's going to get this traffic out, you know, one, two, three of them out of Q2, and then we'll take one out of Q1 and Q4, and then, you know, loop it back around. The interesting part becomes in the bottom right, you see this thing called the priority queue, right? The priority queue is the I'm going to cut in line, right? For those of you, I'm a Southern California guy, so I'm at Disneyland all the time, right? That's the fast pass queue, right? You know it, you guys go to Disneyland, you're standing there and you're waiting to get in line and you're just waiting, and when you see all these people come running up in front of you and you're like, seriously? That's the priority queue, right? You're sitting there in Q3 and you're like, I'm ready to go, and the scheduler's like, sorry, yep, nope. Priority queue, come on, priority queue, right? You got to get through. That's the job of the priority queue. That's where we want real-time traffic, right? Because I don't want stuff in queues 3 and 4 and whatever nudging me out of the way. I want to get out. That's the job of the priority queue. I just put this slide up to show a little bit of fun that you can do with DSCP markings. It can get really complicated, right? I'm not here to turn you into network engineers. I just want to let you know that when you're planning and architecting and designing and discussing these things with your networking people, they may get down to this level. From Link's perspective, you don't want to get trapped in the weeds with this kind of discussion, right? All we care about from Link's perspective is, hey, I can mark my different kinds of traffic. I need you to classify them appropriately. If you're doing, you know, 7 different class selectors and all this, that's great. You're the network engineer. You figure that out. It's my audio needs real time, right? My video needs this. And let the networking engineers put it into their class selectors and put it into their markings as appropriate. Make sure the networking engineers have a good view of the entire infrastructure, right? Here we've got a main campus on the left, a remote site on the right, and you can see that the QoS policies aren't exactly lined up. Right? On the left side, we're doing DSCP markings of video of 36. It's the second line there. But on the right side, you see that video is allowed to be marked as either 36 or 26. That's not consistent. Right? And for QoS to be effective, it needs to be consistent end-to-end. Right? I need to know that if I'm in the priority queue when I leave my PC and hit that first switch, that I'm still going to be in the priority queue when I get to the destination, right? Or if I'm only doing this at the WAN level, same thing. If I'm in the priority queue when I ingress into the MPLS cloud, when I egress out of it, I better still be in the priority queue, right? So make sure that your QoS policies are mapped accordingly. All right, so let's dig into Link. Now we got that out of the way. I mentioned that we do have the capability in Link to mark the traffic. DSCP markings are done by policy-based QoS, and this is a screenshot of what it looks like to do policy-based QoS. This is kind of cool, right? Because number one, we go into Active Directory, which we need anyway, right? We manage it via these policy-based QoS mechanisms, which basically allow us to say, hey, this is the executable, which in this case would be link.exe. I want you to mark the traffic as, in this case, 46, and the one screen cap that we don't hear is it'll actually ask you for a port range, right? So in the link management shell, you'll define various port ranges that say audio would be on this port range, video this port range, and so forth, and you then match that to your policy-based QoS policies that you see here so that the client knows, hey, I'm sending audio out on this particular port range. I then want to tag that as 46 when it leaves my machine. Now the network knows that's tagged 46, that's good stuff, right? That's priority queue stuff. If you're migrating, by the way, from Link 2010 to Link 2013, and you've already pre-configured this, you're going to need to go back and tweak these, right? Because previously we called the executable communicator.exe, you know, and then you may have had that back in the R2 days moving forward. Now it's link.exe, so just, you know, be aware of that if you happen to be restricting it by executable name. Don't forget about QoS for non-client related traffic, right? We can QoS the traffic that comes out of the servers as well. Internet-based remote clients, yeah, to a degree. I mean, again, doing QoS for a user that's coming in across the edge from their home network, yeah, not really going to get you anywhere, because I don't think my home router is really going to do anything with EF46. I'm like, that's nice. Moving on. So, yes, we have that capability. Don't forget about your IP phones, right? They will be set to MARC automatically, and you will control that through Link Control Panel. So you can control if you're not using 46, if you're using something else for some strange reason. You can make those adjustments as well. Traffic coming in from your SIP trunk, let's not forget about those guys, right? I have a carrier SIP trunk that comes in, right? Terminates on my session border controller, on my audio codes, right? Make sure that I'm tracking and getting that traffic tagged appropriately as it comes in to my infrastructure, right? So don't forget about, we do focus a lot on clients because, I mean, let's face it, there is a lot of traffic that gets generated from the client side, but don't forget about the non-client related stuff. It's probably a good idea to validate your end-to-end QoS. As I mentioned before, it is quite possible for things to look like they're configured properly on paper, and then you get into the reality of production, or you get into the reality of test, and you're like, yeah, this isn't right. It is possible someone could go into a router or a switch and just simply enable QoS, right? Well, the default policies that you use to enable QoS strip everything and reset it back to zero, right? So again, you get that junior admin that goes in there, wonder what this command does. Here, hold my beer, watch this. You know, and then next thing you know, any traffic that passes through that device is now getting remarked as zero. So what you had originally tagged as 46, priority queue, is like, nope, it's gonna be treated just like everything else. That's bad, right? So validate these things. You can validate it very simply by using something like Netmon. You know, this is a little snippet that we're showing you in Netmon that actually shows the DSCP markings, right? There's plenty of other tools that you can use. There's a blog here that talks about validating on the link endpoints. There are network tools that you can use to validate this. So there's lots of ways that you can go about this. I won't spend a lot of time digging into that, but certainly come up afterwards or when we do Q&A, and I'm happy to fill in the blanks for you there. Monitoring server is, of course, your best friend. If you did not catch the monitoring session yesterday, I highly advise that you go back and watch the recording on that, because this server is one of the best roles that you will have in Link. Right? Every deployment that I do of Link has a monitoring server, period, end of story. Right? Now, it's even better in 2013 because you don't need a dedicated server. Right? It's all co-located on the front ends, so there's really no reason to not deploy monitoring, but you need monitoring. This is your visibility into the Link environment. And being able to see things like there, you see the color coding, average packet loss 20%. That's not so good. Not just the fact that it's bright red, that's really not good, right? So use the monitoring server to gather this information. Okay. Let's step back a second, because we've kind of had our head down in the weeds looking at quality of service, looking at DSCP markings, and, you know, trying to get this traffic classified appropriately. Now that we kind of understand how those pieces work, let's step back a little bit and see how Link is going to impact the network from a bandwidth perspective. Because the next logical thing that comes up when we talk to networking folks isn't quality of service, it's how much load are you going to put on my network? Oh, you want to do this gallery view thing? Psh, that's going to take like 8 meg of traffic. Nah, sorry, you can't turn that on. That's going to eat up too much traffic. No, it isn't. Let's put those myths to bed in this section and talk about realistically what we can expect from a network bandwidth usage perspective for Link. So to do that, first we're going to talk about the different types of traffic. We'll look at the flows. Specifically, we'll focus in a lot on the video flows and talk about how we do this new modeling process. And then we'll talk about the bandwidth calculator. And if time permits at the end, I'll do a quick little demo of the 2013 bandwidth calculator. Okay, two types of traffic that we look at in Link that are going to impact the network. Server-to-server related traffic and user-generated traffic. We're going to be focusing on the user-generated traffic in this stage, right? There is server-to-server traffic like intrapool communications that are happening at the fabric layer and all kinds of good stuff, signaling, data replication, and so forth that happens between the pool. We're not going to focus so much on that here, specifically because you know the larger amounts of bandwidth that we're dealing with are around media and media flows. That's where the biggest hit tends to come from a bandwidth perspective. So we'll focus on user-generated traffic. So you see on the left we have Alice, on the right we have Bob. Right, we're going to focus on what happens with traffic that goes peer-to-peer between these guys, as well as traffic that may have to flow up to an MCU if they're doing a conference. Now, there's a lot of different types of traffic that Link can generate. Right? Signaling, the SIP traffic, that includes our presence, right? The chats that we do, all the presence, all that kind of stuff is happening over the SIP channel. Right? There's peer-to-peer audio and video. There's a media flow, right, that happens from a point A to point B or from Alice to Bob. There's multi-party audio and multi-party video. That's a Link meeting or a conference, right? I drag that third person in, we move that call up to an AVMCU, and now we're going to be exchanging multi-party audio and video. We may include folks from the PSTN, a dial-in conference, or somebody dialing out to a mobile device. We have our friends, the desktop and application sharing pieces, right? These are all types of traffic that can be generated. The cool thing is, although they are significant, they're predictable. And that's what's key for us, right? We need to be able, if we're designing and planning and architecting, these things have to be predictable, right? I can't go to a networking guy and say, I need anywhere between, you know, 2 and 20 meg per user. No, that's not going to work. I need to be able to predict on the scenarios that we're going through what kind of traffic impact I'm going to have on the wire. Not everything is predictable. As you can see here, file transfers, PowerPoint sharing, attachments and conferences, our friend PChat, right? They can be significant, but they're harder to predict, right? Because file transfer, I could be transferring a 1 meg file, I could be transferring a 100 meg file. I don't know, it's hard to predict that, right? So when we're looking at our modeling exercise, we're going to focus on the previous slide and not so much on these particular items. These are more one-off kind of items that we have to go through to size from a networking perspective. Now, take a quick step into the world of codecs, right? Because we talked earlier about the purpose of a codec, you know, compression, decompression of the audio and the video stream. These are the codecs that we have inside of Link. I tend not to get too hung up on the codecs themselves. I mean, it's good to know them, but there's a lot of intelligence that's been built into the media stack to be able to select the correct codec for the correct scenario. Now, RT Audio, of course, is the one that we would prefer, which we can use for peer-to-peer calling from a wideband perspective, possibly narrowband perspective if the networking needs it, and possibly calls to the PSTN could be going through RT Audio narrowband. G722 is our conferencing codec, and then the /2 is the stereo conferencing codec that we added in for the room systems. We have good old Siren. I left Siren up there, even though we say it's used in live meetings and office communicator, it's still used in Link too, right? We still use the Siren codec. Your Windows mobile phone, Siren. So, you know, we still have the capability of using this codec, right? It's there. G711, the ever popular, all impressive, empowering G711 codec. Yep, there it is. It's used when we talk to our mediation servers. It's used when we talk via media bypass to our PBXs or to our gateways, and it's used by PSTN participants that come in through our AV conferences. Okay? A few bullets there on Exchange UM just for completeness, but we're not digging too much into Exchange UM in this particular one, particular slide. This is another area that, depending on which page you're on TechNet, you'll get different values for the numbers that you see. And again, the reason for that is because the charts are all built around a particular context, right? So am I doing this in the context of planning for call admission control? Am I doing this for planning for network utilization usage? Am I doing this for, you know, the different scenarios at hand, because the numbers tend to be architected slightly differently? This is the chart that I typically go by, so I get to understand what the bandwidth profiles are. Now, whenever you look at numbers, Just like when you look at latency and jitter and things of that nature, you have to wrap the appropriate context around these numbers, right? So when I look at this, I have to know, if I'm looking at that number, what's the packetization interval that I'm looking at for that? Does this include the overhead? Does this include framing? Does this include RTCP? Does this, what am I looking at here? Because invariably, you will get competitors that say, well, you guys don't support G729. Come on. G729 is so much smaller than these. I mean, we take like 8K for that, and your narrowband codec takes 30. Apples and oranges, guys. You're comparing an 8K payload with my 30K, which includes the RTCP traffic, which includes secure RTP, which includes... Nah, apples and oranges. Okay, let's get on a level playing field, and let's talk about how these numbers shake out. Right, so whenever you're looking at these numbers, always look to see, what are they assuming? Do the numbers assume all of these extra overhead pieces, or are we just looking at the raw payload? Right? So these are some good numbers that we look at. I like this chart because it shows the different codecs that we have. On the left is RT audio, the 8 kilohertz is narrowband, right, versus 16 is wideband. So that's the narrowband versus wideband that we talk about. And then down at the bottom, you'll see this FEC, which is called forward error correction. Right? Forward error correction is a mechanism that's built into the client to be able to say, I'm detecting a problem on the network, lost packets, so I'm going to start sending duplicate data, right? In the hopes that I know I'm going to lose 15% of the data that's going across, so I'm going to double up the data so that even though I'm losing it, I'm effectively, quote unquote, using more bandwidth, but I'm still getting the conversation there. That's the idea of forward error correction. That's something that kicks in automatically. That is not something you should ever engineer for, okay? You shouldn't be planning and go, oh, well, I'll just use the big numbers down there under FEC and we're covered. Now, if you're seeing those things getting up into those number ranges, you've got a problem on your network, right? Because FEC kicks in when there's a problem with packet loss. So don't budget more bandwidth just because we're gonna double it up. Go fix the packet loss problem so that FEC doesn't kick in. And again, you can pick that out of the monitoring report. A fun slide on packetization time, right? Packetization time basically is the duration of audio that's sent, the amount of sampling of data that we capture and stuff into a UDP packet. And what I find interesting about this slide, which is one of the reasons that I put it in here, was by changing the packetization interval, we can actually stuff more data into a packet, a UDP packet. So you see on the left, that's our standard 20 millisecond packetization time. Right, so you see we've got the overhead, which is 70 bytes, that stays consistent, and I've got 20 milliseconds of audio, and I've got a total of about 57K of traffic. Sweet. Well, if I double up the packetization time from 20 to 40 milliseconds, look at the overall size of the packet. 43 kilobits. Right? I'm actually using less, but I'm adding delay, right, because I've added another 20 milliseconds. Of delay into there because I'm stuffing more. So I've got to wait a little bit longer to capture more so I can stuff more into the UDP packet and send it on its merry way. The cool thing about this, the media stack will automatically adjust these for you based on underlying network conditions. Heck, it can even adjust this based on conditions like call admission control, for example. Right? I could set a call admission control policy and maybe I set it to a maximum of 50K for the session. And the system goes, you know what? This link client talking to that link client, I really want to use RT Audio wideband for a good quality call. But I can't fit that with a 20 millisecond packetization interval because that's 57, the limit's 50. Aha. I'm going to switch that to a 40 millisecond packetization interval and now I got under the 50 limit and you and I are doing wideband RT Audio. Smart stuff, right? This is just one example of how intelligent the media stack can be. And it's great that we have that. Again, just don't rely on that as being the end-all, be-all, and we don't need QoS. Oh, yeah, you do. This is just one piece of the puzzle that can help optimize the experience on the network. Now, comparing this to 2010, the list that you see here, these are things that haven't really changed all that much, right? Signaling, peer-to-peer audio, multi-party audio, PSTN audio, desktop apps, that's all pretty much the same as it was in Link 2010. Right, there's no real apparent differences, especially from planning and from a usage perspective. The one that's changed big time is video. And it's because of the addition of a new codec that we have, which is H.264. This new codec is the de facto codec that we will use for peer-to-peer video as well as multi-party video from a Link 2013 perspective. Now, we still have the old RT video codec for back compat with Link 2010, for example. And we do have the capability of supporting a very large range of resolutions, right? Think about Link 2010. Anybody know how many video resolutions we had in Link 2010? This is the interactive part. You know, I think somebody's out there. I can sort of see shadows of people. So I think there's people out there. Anybody know how many there were? A little less than 10. There's a little more than one. Yeah, somebody had it up over there, right? Three. Yeah, that was it, right? Remember you went into your policies and you had the ability, you had SIF, you had VGA, and then you had, for peer-to-peer, you had HD. And that was it, right, in the Link 2010 space. In the Link 2013 world, with the H.264 codec, we have, I haven't counted them all, but we have like up to 30 different resolutions that we can do, from sub-SIF all the way to full-on 1080p HD. Woo! That's a lot of resolutions, right? We need to be able to account for that when we're doing our planning. Not to mention the fact that that's not just peer-to-peer, that extends into the multi-party video conferences too. Right? We had the easy way out in the 2010 world, if you will, because we didn't have HD video in our conferences. You had SIF and you had VGA, and that was it. Right? The only way that you got HD or 720p was to do peer-to-peer, and even then it had to be like full screen, and you had to have a quad-core processor, you know, all these goofy limitations, right? H.264 SVC, yeah. Don't need to worry about that now. We've got up to at least 30 different resolutions that we can do. So how do we deal with that? Well, to deal with that, we first need to kind of walk through and understand the traffic flows for video. And I'm going to start with the simplest option, right, which is our peer-to-peer. So we have a couple of branch users there. We've got Alice in branch site 2 in this case. We have Bob, the builder, in branch site 1. And Alice is going to call Bob. Great. So we've got a peer-to-peer traffic flow. And in this case, because it's a Link client, Link 2013 client, to Link 2013 client, we're going to use the H.264 SVC codec. Now, with the H.264 codec, we have, first of all, different aspect ratios. Right? We can do 4:3 or we can do 16:9. Right? You have a widescreen webcam, you have a widescreen monitor, you can do 16:9. Sweet. You're in the panorama view, you got 20:3, right? You could do that if you have like one of those round table devices, the little upside down Starship Enterprise thingies, right? You know, those types of devices, we can do panoramas. Again, we talked about the resolutions. We can go from sub-SIF all the way up to 1080p. What do you think controls what resolutions we use? Okay, available bandwidth could be one. Is there something the user can do? It's on the slide. The video window size, right? This is a way that the user can directly impact the resolution, right? Think about it. Alice makes a call to Bob, and they've got their video call set up, and now Alice full screens Bob's video. Well, she's going to signal over to Bob, dude, I need to see you in HD, right? 16:9, 1080p HD, because I just put you on my big perceptive pixel, you know, display. I want to see you in HD. Right? And then maybe Bob on the other side is like, video, minimize, right? And just kind of gets it down to this little tiny square. Maybe he's only doing 240p. The video window size is going to directly impact the resolutions that are chosen. Right? Because as I resize the window, I have to, through the RTCP channel, I have to say to the other side, dude, I've resized your window. I need a different resolution from you. Right? Your PC capabilities can dictate that as well, right? But we don't have a starch requirement like we had before where it was like you have to have a quad-core processor and whatnot. H.264 SVC is much happier to accommodate that. But we do have the ability to take advantage of hardware acceleration, CPU, GPU cores, and so forth, so that can come into play as well. What we find most commonly, peer-to-peer is about 460K from a common window size distribution, meaning if Alice calls Bob and they just let the link client open in its default state, that's pretty much what you're going to see. On average, about 460. Whereas, of course, you could adjust that to, I mean, anywhere up to, you know, 4 gig if you like. I mean, you know, it totally depends, or 4 meg if you like, 4 gig. That'd be a nice video display. need more coffee. 4 meg if you like, but not everybody's going to expand everything out to a full HD video stream. And you'll see when we look in a little bit the modeling aspects that we've taken into account to kind of build up these user models from a planning perspective. From a numbers perspective, you need to add 10K for the RTCP channel. RTCP is the real-time control protocol. This is the channel that we use to do this discussion and change of ratios and resolutions and so forth. Right? You could do it in the SIP signaling channel, but that's messy, right? Because that would be re-invites and more SDPs, and I mean, this, it's just too much hassle to do it there. So we do it in the RTCP plane. And basically say, hey, Alice just made Bob's screen really big. Bob, give me a different resolution, right? And then Bob's client will respond back by simulcasting the correct stream back to her. In the case that we have a Link 2010 client in the mix, we have to downshift to RT Video because the Link 2010 clients don't understand H.264 SVC. So there's a backwards compatibility piece that we need to be aware of. By the way, just a little side note, whenever we talk about networking traffic, there's always two pieces, signaling and media, okay? That's true when it comes to video as well. And unfortunately, most people look at the fact that we have H.264 SVC and they're like, sweet, now you can interop with every video vendor out there that supports H.264 SVC or supports H.264 AVC. And the truth of the matter is, it's, you can't, right? Because although the codecs are there, the signaling channels don't like each other yet. Right, that's part of our challenge with Cisco VCS integration, for example. Right, they don't understand the signaling that we're doing in the HTTP channel, so it doesn't work. So we've got to put intermediaries in between, or they've got to fix their VCS software to make it understand us. So don't think just because you support H.264 that interop is a thing of the past, because it's not. Now, this is where it gets kind of fun. And my definition of fun is probably not the same as yours. They don't let me out much, so... when I look at video conferencing with multi-view, this is where it gets entertaining. Now, the blue lines that you see here, they're pretty thick lines, right? And they're pretty thick lines for a purpose, because in the next few slides, I'm going to step you through what happens as each person joins into the conference and what the streams are going to look like. So first off, we're going to do multiple video streams in Link 2013. It's a concept that's called the gallery view. Now, the video stream itself will be in 16:9, so it'll be widescreen, from the client up to the AVMCU. However, the AVMCU, when that gets pushed back down to the client, is going to instruct the client on the other end, we've got to clip that. So instead of that rectangle, we've got the little square tile, right? It's a concept called smart framing that the client does. It basically takes your widescreen and clips it down to center your head inside of a square that's 240p, right, rather than the wide 16:9. It also gives you the cool aspect, though, if somebody was sitting next to me and they kind of moved their head into my view, we would automatically stretch that into a rectangle to get both of us in there. It's kind of fun. You'll probably see that in, I think Andrew Schneiderman's got a conferencing session a little later this week. You'll probably see it in there. So first person joins. This is Alice. She sends her video stream up to the AVMCU, right? These other two guys join into the meeting, and they receive the stream down from the AVMCU. Clipped off, life is good. So now Alice is in there, and Bob and Charlie are actually seeing the video stream that's coming down from Alice. Of course, when Bob joins, same thing happens, right? He sends his video stream up, video streams go down to the other two, and same thing when Charlie joins, his video stream goes up, video streams come down, and it starts to look like this. Now you know why those arrows were so thick. Now, you'll have at most 5 video tiles. What we typically see in usage modeling that we've done is about 2 to 3. Right? You may have 5 people in the gallery, but maybe only 2 or 3 of them are actually sending video. The others are just, you know, static pictures that are in there. That's a very common scenario that we see. Right? The use case really fits more around the 2 to 3 people showing active video versus all 5 people showing video all at the same time. Now, again, we've got that range of resolutions that go from here to here, right? We don't have to account for all of that nonsense in conferences, right? Because remember, what's the first thing that we do when we join the conference? We clip it, and in general, that initial square out of the gate is going to be 240p. That's a single tile resolution. If you were to add in some kind of sharing, like desktop share or app share or something of that nature, what happens? The video goes whoop, up to the top, and it gets even smaller, doesn't it? Right? Because we want to bring your attention to the content. Woo. We want to bring your attention to the content, right? And not so much the video, right? The video moves up because that's kind of where your webcam would be anyway, so that's where your eyes would flow. But the content becomes the center stage. So that kind of drops us down even further from 240p to like 180p. So the amount of bandwidth that we're using actually decreases from a video perspective when we start adding in content sharing. Now, of course, the user can impact this, right? We could stretch the video out, or we could bop it out and move it to another screen and, you know, make it bigger. But generally, when we see folks using the link client, these are the numbers that we're finding. And you'll see this when we do the modeling in just a second. The clients have the capability of doing what's called simulcast, which is sending up multiple streams or receiving multiple streams. Now, the receive one's not that big of a deal, right? Because you think about it, if I'm Alice, I'm of course receiving two streams, right? I'm receiving Bob's and Charlie's, right? So you don't think much about the downstream, multiple, yeah, it's no problem. But your client's also going to simulcast up multiple streams as well. Think about it. I'm simulcasting it up, and I'm Alice, sending up my video stream. Bob has taken the video and left it at its default, so no app sharing, just me, 240p, right? Charlie has taken the video and popped it out, put it on a new monitor, and expanded it to get a higher resolution of video. Well, she's going to signal back, Charlie's going to signal back to my client, Alice, and say, hey, I need a different resolution. Okay, I'll simulcast up that resolution for Charlie along with the resolution that I'm sending up for Bob. Bob will pick his, Charlie will pick hers. Life is good, right? The AVMCU is a traffic cop, right? That's his job. There is no transcoding, there's no muxing, there's no, the AVMCU doesn't do that, right? The AVMCU is a switching MCU. Hey, this is, okay, you go there, you go, that's his job, right? It's not bring this together and combine it into one big stream and send it, no, that's not what we do, right? And this is what allows us to get this flexibility. Oh, you want a different resolution? You got it. Oh, you want it? Oh, you got it, right? All part of what we call, another feature that we have is called temporal scalability, which there's a little bit of intelligence that can be built into the client. So here, the user in branch two, which is Bob, his network connection's going a little bit flaky, right? So he can signal back up to the AVMCU and go, dude, I'm having some problem with my video. Could you adjust the frame rate for me? Okay. So instead of 30 frames per second, we'll send 15 frames per second, right? Temporal scalability, it's built into the H.264 codec, right? So SVC can adapt to that and go, oh, he's having some network problems? Okay, fix his stream. Everybody else, y'all are good on 30 frames per second. Sweet. Go for it. Bob, sorry about your luck. Here, we'll give you 15 frames per second. Is that better? Yeah. Great. We can dynamically adapt to that. It's great. And, of course, if you've got someone that decides to join in with Link 2010, don't forget about the fact that we would have to add in RT video into the mix. So having said all that, how in the heck do you model for this? Cool thing is, this modeling data that we have here, this is based on our TAP customers that did the initial preview of 2013. The usage of video, that modality, actually doubled compared to 2010. Not the bandwidth, right? The actual usage of video doubled because we've made video more prevalent in the client, right? But we found that the P2P video calls generally can range anywhere from 180p to 1080p, right? All depending on how the user sizes their windows. But the conferences really sit more in that 240p range, the 424 by 240, which is the clip to square. And generally, we see an average of about 2.5, which is, you know, 2 to 3 video streams, which means that we're not actually seeing the death of the network because we've now put link video conferencing in, right? I've gone to customers right away where they say, we're not turning on the gallery view. Why? Because you're going to saturate my network. Really? We're actually going to use more bandwidth on a peer-to-peer video call than we will on a conference. And you're telling me that you don't want to turn that on, but you're going to let them do peer-to-peer conferences? Nah. Let's get that wrapped around and understand, right? And of course, as we say on the bottom there, if you turn on screen sharing or app sharing or whatever, it even further reduces the video because we pop everything up higher And now we go down to that 180p resolution instead of 240. That's the 320 by 180. Look on the TechNet documents, right? This is entertaining. You see audio-video planning capacity for conferences versus peer-to-peer, and yes, that's not a misprint. The numbers are actually smaller for conferences than they are for peer-to-peer. And it's because of the default window sizes that we use, right? The default window size on peer-to-peer is bigger than it is for conferences, hence higher resolution, more video bandwidth. Conferences are 240p by default, less bandwidth that would be required, right, from a min and max standpoint. It's kind of fun. So it's a new model, it's a new paradigm, right? Unfortunately, the first model that people think about is, oh my gosh, I have five video streams, Link can do 1080p at like 2 meg per times five. Oh, I gotta use that much. No, you can't have five HD 1080p video streams in a conference. You can't, right? You can't break out each particular one into its own full screen. You get the gallery and you gotta make, now I guess if everybody has 80 inch per second pixels on their desk, that's a different story. But if you got enough money to do that, bandwidth shouldn't be your problem. So wouldn't worry too much about that one. The way I want to wrap this up, running a little short on time here, but the way I want to wrap this up is all that fun stuff that we just talked about, we don't want you to have to hurt your brain trying to think about these calculations and, oh, what do I do for this, what do I do for that? Use our bandwidth calculator, all right? The Link 2013 bandwidth calculator is available now to help you model bandwidth consumption based on all these principles that I just talked about. So all the fun numbers that I just went through and resolutions and all this and all that, it's in the tool, right? You can follow this Excel spreadsheet, and this Excel spreadsheet will allow you to build different personas, different usages, different modeling. And the cool thing is this allows you to basically see how Link is going to impact your network before you even get Link onto your network. And I'm going to switch to Q&A here at the moment. If anyone wants to see the bandwidth calculator, we'll come up and you can come up afterwards, and I'll take you through a quick demo of it. But I want to make sure that I give a few seconds for Q&A. So if anybody has any questions, we'll throw you over to the mics. If you don't have any questions and you want to head out, fantastic. I hope you enjoyed the session. And please make sure you remember to fill out your evals. And if anybody has any questions, we'll open up to the group. If not, have a great rest of the conference.